This morning, we have a special guest from the city of Minneapolis, policy director Peter Wagenius, who's coming to here talk about transit and specifically alternative types of transit that the city of Minneapolis is looking to promote and build and develop here. So please give Peter, and by the way, just I've actually known Peter since high school, so props to Minneapolis South High for producing so many great people for the city of Minneapolis. And with that, I'd like to welcome Peter Wagenius. Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, thanks for having me. I wanted to ask a couple of questions to get a sense of the audience here. Raise your hand if you live in either Minneapolis or St. Paul. Raise your hand if you live outside the city of Minneapolis or St. Paul. Okay, great. That's very helpful to know. I want to ask just a couple more questions. Raise your hand if you've... Oh, I see some more folks coming. Raise your hand if you have had occasion to ride the light rail line. Okay, almost everybody, it seems like. Let me ask one more question. Have you had the opportunity, you know, perhaps in Portland or Seattle, to ride a streetcar or in Europe?
Or in Minneapolis.
I was referring to a modern streetcar in the last 10 years. Raise your hand if you rode a streetcar in the city of Minneapolis. Excellent. I love that. Okay, that's great.
That shows how young you are.
That shows how young I am. That's correct. I should have been more precise in my questions. My last question is, I'm guessing, I know Peter McLaughlin has been here to talk about transit. How many people have seen his presentation? Okay, wonderful. Knowing that, I made a point of trying not to duplicate with his presentation, so I'm not going to talk about high-speed rail to Duluth or Chicago or commuter rail. I'm going to have a pretty focused conversation on a couple of topics. The summary of what I want to talk about is right there on page two. We need to build light rail transit where it makes sense. But even while we build LRT, we need to ask ourselves, what's next? I think the answer to that question will be that we need to build cost-effective alternatives to LRT on other corridors where LRT is not appropriate. That's my basic case. So let's dive in. Let's start by asking the question, where does LRT work? Well, we know LRT works on Hiawatha. Wow, what a success that has been. It's proof that one successful project can change anything. Folks, come on, and there's actually a space up front here. And there's a table in the corner as well. We know that one successful project can change the whole conversation, and boy, Hiawatha proved that. I can tell you that I know certain business folks downtown, who I won't name them to embarrass them, who were on the lists of the Trails Not Rails that was against the Southwest LRT line that would go to the southwestern suburbs, and then Hiawatha opened. And then, over the course of about a year or two, some of those names disappeared from that list, and they were on the lists of Go Southwest and committees pushing for the rail line to happen faster. So it's a success on Hiawatha. It will be a huge success on Central, despite all the pain and agony of the process to get there. And it'll be a huge success on Southwest. After that, it becomes less clear. But to answer the question, what might be next after those three, let's start with funding. The next page after that I called the money challenge, federal. Here's the reality of getting transit projects done. We are much more likely to get a project built with a federal partner. That is how we've built every project up to now. Half of the money for the Central Corridor LRT project is coming from the federal government. It was even more for Hiawatha. It'll be the same for Southwest. If you don't have a federal partner, it's a lot harder. And I know cities that have done things, major projects without federal partners, it's hard. It can be done, but it's hard. Now, what does that mean? That means that abiding by the federal funding formula is crucial, absolutely crucial. I wrote underneath there, I wrote Peter's last words. It's a little trick there. I'm not actually referring to me. I'm actually referring to Peter Bell's last words. Now, I know it's a little dangerous to quote a Pawlenty appointee at the DFL Education Foundation. Peter Bell, as you know, was chair of the Metropolitan Council. And we certainly had our fights at the city with Peter Bell. But I also had the occasion to be in a series of meetings over the course of 3 years negotiating the Central Corridor Project through the University of Minnesota. When we came up with our first agreement, the one that was supposed to take 3 months and took 6 months, as opposed to the one that was supposed to take another 6 months and took another 3 years, the primary negotiators at that table were Kathleen O'Brien from the University of Minnesota, Peter McLaughlin from Hennepin County, Peter Bell from the Met Council, and Peter Wagenius from the city of Minneapolis. You'll notice that that's Kathy and the three Peters, which somebody pointed out once. If that sounds to you like the worst idea for a pop group that Phil Spector ever had, you're right. But what we did together at that table is we wrestled with that federal funding formula, that awful federal funding formula where you try and get a project through that. It's hard. It's really hard. And while the Obama administration has changed that, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit, it's still there, and it's still really hard. And this brings me back to Peter's last words. Peter Bell, when he was in his last 6 months in office, he said a lot more things, a lot more blatantly than he had in his previous 7.5 years. And he said, I think over the next 50 years, there's only going to be 3 LRT lines in the Twin Cities metropolitan region. Now, is that Peter Bell being a Pawlenty appointee? Well, you could argue that. But having wrestled the federal funding formula with Peter Bell, with Peter McLaughlin, with Kathleen O'Brien, trying to get that project built, I don't think that's why he was saying that. I think that is a correct read of the federal funding formula, that we're going to have a hard time getting any other LRT projects past the federal government. I'm a little bit more optimistic than Peter Bell. I think the Botno project, and I'll talk about that in a little bit later, I think we could maybe get that one. But if we're asking the question, what's next after these LRT projects, I submit to you that the answer is not more LRT projects. That's not the answer. Certainly from a financial standpoint, that's not the answer if we're looking for the federal government to be a partner. So that's the money challenge in the federal government. Next page, I said the money challenge in Minnesota. First line I wrote there is, $2 a gallon equals magical thinking. Raise your hand if you think you might know what I mean by that. Right here.
Gas at $2 a gallon.
Absolutely right. Gas at $2 a gallon is not the future. That's crazy. The future is higher and higher gas prices. But I actually wrote that on there for two reasons. You got one of them. Let me tell you what the other reason is that I wrote $2 a gallon equals magical thinking. After spending the last 10 years building lots of big new projects, MnDOT did a report about this time last year. And it was called the Metro Highway Investment Study. And they asked themselves, how much would it cost to build all the things that we currently have on our state plans in the metro area to maintain all of what we've already built? How much does that cost? Everything that we're intending to build ourselves out of congestion, plus to maintain all of the highways and roads and bridges we've already built. And the answer to that question is it would take so much money, it would be the equivalent of a $2 a gallon increase in the gas tax. Think about that for just a second. And I'm not talking about the wisdom of that as public policy. A gas tax increase would actually promote transit, promote efficiency, promote energy independence. But just let's talk about that as a political reality for a second. $2 a gallon gas tax increase? Does anyone think that's going to happen in the state of Minnesota? In order for Margaret Anderson Kelleher and Larry Pogue-Miller to get the transportation bill passed a couple years ago to increase the gas tax a few cents, every single Democrat had to vote for it, plus 6 Republicans had to risk their political careers, 4 of them getting booted out of the legislature by Republicans for it, to get a couple of cents. And yet our transportation planning is based on the notion that someday there's going to be so much revenue dropping on metro freeways, it'll be the equivalent of a $2 a gallon gas tax increase. I submit that our transportation planning is magical thinking. So when I wrote that $2 gallon equals magical thinking, it had two meanings. You got one, and that's the other. So that's the Minnesota funding situation. At the same time, our region needs to grow. More importantly, it's going to grow whether we want it to or not. How are we going to accommodate that growth when we're so far away from a pay-as-you-go transportation system, from an honestly funded transportation system? If that's the shore, we're out at sea and we can't see it through a telescope. So, amongst other things, that means we have to maximize the capacity of the lane miles we have already built and we already own. And we're going to do that through transit. We're going to do it through real choices. We're going to do it through innovation. Let me just let that thought sink in for a second and switch gears and come back to LRT for a moment. So we talked about the financial limits of LRT within the federal funding formula. Let's talk about the other limits of LRT. First, cost. LRT is expensive. It is, for a region of this size, it's the most expensive tool in the toolbox. Now, I don't say that to say we're opposed to LRT. We are big fans of LRT on all the corridors where I described earlier. There are places where it makes sense to use the most expensive tool in the toolbox, where if you didn't do that, you'd regret it. But it is the most expensive tool in the toolbox. It's big. It's very big. It's not like the modern, the classic streetcars. You all know that. The new LRT lines, three-car LRT lines, are as long as a city block. The classic streetcars weren't that length. The current modern streetcars aren't that length. Construction impacts. For anyone who lives along University Avenue, the construction impacts of LRT are big. It requires going way down deep. They're taking out the entire street. It's going to take 4 years. It's going to have impacts on the businesses there. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing. We just have to live through construction impacts to do worthwhile projects. But we should reckon with that, and we should reckon with that honestly. Development is another issue. LRT, because it's so big, because it requires its own right-of-way, where do we end up putting LRT? We end up putting it on the corridors that are not the places where we most want to densify the city and develop new housing. I put a little map on your page there next to the limits of LRT. This is a map of street widths within the city of Minneapolis. If you look at that map, we have a handful of streets that are 200 feet wide or wider. Those are the blue streets you all see on there. Hiawatha Avenue is on there. Olson Memorial Highway, these are technically state highways. Those are big. You can fit LRT on them or next to them. We have a few more that are pretty big. University Avenue, past the university, east of the university, is pretty big, 120 feet or more. But most of the streets in Minneapolis are not that big. Even if we had the money to build LRT on other streets in Minneapolis, it probably wouldn't fit without dramatic impacts. So I'm relating this right-of-way question back to the development question. LRT is big enough that it pushes us, when we think, where do we want to run an LRT line? It pushes us away from the streets that we think have the greatest capacity to grow new residents. When we look at the city and we say to ourselves, where do we have the greatest capacity to infill where there's a gas station and build, new senior highs, housing, or mixed-use development where there's three floors of housing and there's a laundromat or a dry cleaner in the first door. When we look for places like that, it's not Hiawatha Avenue, it's not Olson, it's Hennepin Avenue, Nicollet Avenue, Chicago, University Avenue right down here. It's Broadway, it's Central Avenue through Northeast. And LRT wouldn't fit on any of them. Maybe Central, but probably not any of the others. So LRT has limits. And they're not just financial limits. Here's the good news. The good news is we can put more tools in our transit toolbox. And this is going to summarize the whole rest of our conversation. To bring high-speed transit to outer ring suburbs decades faster, we can build real bus rapid transit, BRT, on highways, on interstates, in HOT lanes. To redevelop and densify the urban core, we can upgrade from buses to modern streetcars on key developable corridors where LRT is too big and too costly. Now, these two technologies are very different. Why am I wrapping them together? Well, they're very different, but they have two things in common. Both of these tools cost much less than LRT, and they use right-of-way that we already own, that we, the public, already own. And considering, again, back to the financial situation of the state, and we got to maximize the capacity, the lane miles we've already built, this is a very big deal. Let me also just take a second, and I think I don't need to convince this room, but these goals that I connect to these modes to bring high-speed transit to outer ring suburbs decade faster, that matters, even if you live in Minneapolis. That matters for downtown Minneapolis. It matters for Minneapolis being a regional partner, ensuring that we have a system that people across the metro area feel invested in. If I was just here from Minneapolis, I could say, yeah, let's just focus on that streetcar thing. But if we want a transit system that is broadly supported through the region, we got to get out further, and we got to get out further faster. They got to see transit coming to their cities in third-tier suburbs, or they're not going to be willing to participate in doing things that might be a block away here on University Avenue. It's good regionalism. It's good for the city. It's good for both. I would also argue to people in third and fourth and fifth-tier suburbs, the building density in the urban core is a good thing for the whole region. In the city of Minneapolis, we know this. We have the capacity to handle 100,000 more residents in the city of Minneapolis. How do we know this? Because there used to be 100,000 more residents in the city of Minneapolis. What's more, we already have the infrastructure built for them. The roads already exist. The sewers exist. The water system already exists. When they have to build a new suburb to handle 100,000 more people, they got to build all that stuff from scratch. The new sewers, the new roads, the new water systems. In Minneapolis, if we accommodated that growth through transit-oriented development along key developable corridors, we wouldn't need to build new roads, we wouldn't need to build new sewers, we wouldn't need to build, as a matter of fact, our water and sewer rates would go down because our system is built for a population that is 100,000 people bigger and using the amount of water they used back in 1954. Believe me, one of my responsibilities for the mayor is also to work on the budget, including very non-sexy topics like the water fund. We would love to have 100,000 more people in the city of Minneapolis and all our water bills would drop. But there's a regional interest in this because the region ends up paying for new roads, new water systems, new sewer systems out in third and fourth tier suburbs. So I just wanted to put that context there. So let's jump into the first of these two technologies. And at this point, you're now seeing a presentation that I've given to the Downtown Council, you know, key executives forum, the Downtown Council Chamber of Commerce. I gave it to the Northeast Chamber of Commerce, which Edie saw, and she said, hey, Peter, you should come to the DFL Education Foundation. So if you like this presentation, credit her. If you don't, blame me. So what are we going to cover when we talk about streetcars? This is on the slide that says today's presentation. We're going to talk about changes in federal funding opportunities for streetcar projects. We're going to talk about what are streetcars, because they're not necessarily like LRT. They're also not like classic streetcars that used to run on our city streets. We're going to talk specifically about Minneapolis and about the proposal that we have and the grant we got from the federal government. So the next slide says January 13th, 2010 on it. This was a great day. January 13th, 2010 was the day that everything changed across the United States of America for people like me who believe in urban transportation, who believe in redeveloping and revitalizing and growing urban core cities. January 13th was the day the Obama administration said that formula, the formula I was talking about before that Peter McLaughlin and Peter Wagenius and Peter Bell and Kathleen O'Brien wrestled with, they changed that formula, the Obama administration did. It still exists, but it used to be a pass-fail test where they said, if you don't meet this number, you're out, forget it. And that formula only valued, or not only, it disproportionately valued travel times, speed. Well, one of the things you know about streetcars, if you rode on them in pre-1954 or in other cities today, is streetcars aren't about speed. It's not about running 55 miles an hour. It's about the fact that it's so convenient because you pick it up and you're not going that far. You're not going from here to Burnsville. You're going from here to downtown. So it doesn't need to be that fast because you're not going that far. But when the travel time was the dominant criteria, you could never get a streetcar project past that. For that matter, we could barely get LRT lines past that formula. Well, Ray LaHood said, Obama's Secretary of Transportation said when he changed the formula, we will finally be able to make the case for investing in popular streetcar projects and other transit systems that people want and that our old ways of doing business didn't value enough. He did this specifically for streetcars, but you didn't read about that here in the Twin Cities. Why not? I'll tell you why not. Because Ray LaHood came to the Twin Cities to talk about another impact of this decision. And the other impact of this decision was, and you may have heard this from Peter McLaughlin, because of this change, they were able to add back in three new stations onto the Central Corridor line in the city of St. Paul, which had been taken out early in the process. And the community celebrated. That's great news. Wonderful. I was there. It was very exciting. But the story that was being told in all these other cities got buried. In all these other cities, they weren't talking about the Central Corridor line and adding three new stations onto in St. Paul. They were talking about streetcars. Because that was one of the explicit intents of this decision. In case anybody doubted that the Obama administration was serious about urban transit and moving forward with streetcars, they started giving real money away, not planning dollars, construction dollars to build streetcar projects. February 17th, 2010, a little more than a month later, four cities, Dallas, New Orleans, Portland, and Tucson, got between $23 and $63 million to construct streetcar lines. Next page, July 8th. Charlotte, Cincinnati, Fort Worth, and St. Louis each got another $25 million to build streetcar lines. Dallas got an additional $5 million on top of their earlier allocation. October 2010, next slide. Atlanta and Salt Lake City got $48 and $26 million to build streetcar lines. And then if you look at that next page, federal capital funds for streetcar, this summarizes all those previous three slides. You will see the 10 cities that got between 23 and, in the end, 75 for Portland, million dollars to build streetcar lines. Now, I want us to kind of absorb this list. Look at the cities on this list. New York City ain't there. Chicago ain't there. The cities on this list are our peer cities. Portland is on here. That's a peer city for us. Dallas is on here. That's a peer city for us. Charlotte is on here. That's a peer city for us. There is, frankly, some of the cities on this list are less than our peer cities. Fort Worth, Tucson, St. Louis, they're building streetcars and we're not? We should be embarrassed about this. And let me tell you, when I talk to the downtown business community about this, they're embarrassed by this. And that's a big positive change that we have seen in the last year. I can tell you more about that later. My point here is there is nothing superior about these cities or the projects that they put forward to the federal government. The only reason they are building streetcars with federal money and the city of Minneapolis, St. Paul, this region, this state are not bringing those federal dollars back to this region, the only reason is because they took streetcars seriously earlier and they built the local partnerships to make it happen. Coming to the next slide. December 21st, 2010, was the good day for Minneapolis. Not as good as getting $23 million to build a line, but we nonetheless won because there are a lot more cities that want to build streetcar lines than those 10 cities that got the funding. We were able to compete successfully in a very competitive process to get $900,000 from the federal government to do the next phase of streetcar planning in the city of Minneapolis. And I'll come back to the details of this. But this is to actually enter the federal process. We match that with $300,000, so we have $1.2 million to look at taking the Nicollet Avenue bus line and the Central Avenue bus line, the two lines that get married at Nicollet Mall downtown and overlap downtown on Nicollet Mall, to turn those two bus lines into streetcars. So let's take a... We'll come back to Nicollet and Central Avenue. Let's take a second to just talk about what are streetcars. What are streetcars? And this is, we're on the first page of the picture now. Streetcars operate on fixed rail, just like LRT. Unlike LRT, streetcars can operate in mixed traffic. So cars can drive on the tracks in front of them, behind them, not just across them at particular intersections, but streetcars can be mixed in with traffic just like a bus can. They can have their own right-of-way, too. My point is they don't need it. LRTs have to have their own right-of-way. They're about activity center circulation. They're not about, you know, going from Burnsville to Minneapolis at high speed. They're about dense corridors where you might, you know, pick it up at your house to just take it two stops down a few blocks away to get to the laundromat and back or the grocery store or to your job. Visible routing attracts regular and occasional riders. This is not the main reason to support streetcars. I'll get to the bigger reasons in a minute. But it really does matter to the transit rider. All the little things matter to transit riders in terms of their experience. And one of the things people experience downtown is they you know, walk out and they think, boy, am I going to take transit? I've been driving to my job for the past 3 years. There are all these buses that go by, and they all have three-digit numbers, and I don't know which one goes where, and the system is so confusing, and how does this all work? You know what they see when they see a streetcar lane? They see tracks in the ground, and they know exactly where it goes. They know exactly where it goes. And it's not going to turn off those tracks. It's on those tracks. They know where it's going. And it does matter. And the federal government now knows that it matters. Under the Bush administration, they used to pretend that there wasn't this thing called rail bias. And the Obama administration now recognizes this. In case anybody doesn't know the impact of elections, boy, on transportation, we know the impact of elections. The old administration used to argue with the customer. You should love buses as much as we say you should love buses. You should. You should. And the new administration says, you know what, we're going to stop arguing with the customer. The customer says they prefer rail. We're going to factor that into our formulas. They prefer rail. And for the record, we're not against buses. Buses will continue to be the transportation system for 95% of Minneapolis streets. But on streets where we can do better, we should try and do better. And we shouldn't argue with the customer when they tell us what's better. Next page about what are streetcars. For the purposes of Minneapolis, we're only talking about modern vehicles. It was one of the first decisions we made when we started looking at streetcars in the city about 5 years ago. There are cities who run what are called legacy systems. There are also a few places where they take streetcars and try and make them vintage looking, but they're not vintage looking. We didn't consider that either. The reason we didn't look at a legacy system is, frankly, we couldn't afford it. San Francisco's bought everything, every well-working vehicle from 50 years ago, and there are lots of vehicles from 50, 60 years ago that are still working. That is another advantage of streetcars. They last forever. Steel wheels on steel rails, incredibly smooth, durable vehicles. There were streetcars running on the city of Minneapolis in 1954 that were still running in Mexico City at the turn of the century, meaning the year 2000. Show me a bus that lasts anywhere near that long. No, they're rubber tires on asphalt, and they rattle themselves apart. Streetcars last a long time. But San Francisco has bought the American streetcars for their system, so we're only looking at modern vehicles because we really don't have a choice. They operate as single cars, as opposed to LRT, which can operate in three-car trains. They're powered by electric power, just like LRT, but it's usually a single wire as opposed to a double wire because they're smaller. They have multiple doors. This really matters in a place like downtown Minneapolis. Low floor, wide door, smooth ride. Lots of people can get on at a big destination all at once, just like LRT, not so much like most of the buses you'll see. To give you a sense of scale, look at this next slide. This is really helpful. What are streetcars? You see those, you see that bus at the top, 40 feet? And then the next thing is an articulated bus, the one kind that bend in the middle, about 60 feet. Streetcar is a little bit bigger than that, a little bit bigger capacity, 67 feet. Compare that to the fourth line is LRT as it began operations on Hiawatha 5-6 years ago. That was a two-car train, two 94-foot vehicles. Well, we've since extended those platforms and bought more vehicles, and now they're running in three-car trains, or some of them are. And you can see that's as long as a city block. So when you compare that third line, the white and red vehicle, a streetcar, with that third line, full-length LRT, you see just how dramatic a difference we're talking about. That streetcar, amongst other things, can turn an urban corner. It could turn from, on one of these streets, it could turn from 4th to go on Hennepin. LRT couldn't do that. It would have to take, it's much bigger, to have to take a much wider turn. You'd have to take out buildings for it to make a turn like that. Couldn't do it. What are streetcars? Next slide. Where it says the blue vehicle, it says South Waterfront on the front. Very simple stations. The cost is much lower than LRT, usually 1/3 to 1/4 the cost per mile. Much less construction impact than LRT. Out in Portland, Portland's kind of the gold standard for streetcars. They started 10 years ago without a federal partner. They broke all the rules, and they found really cheap ways to do everything, including this method of construction that allowed them to get in and out of an individual street in 3 weeks. They'd do 3 weeks in one block, and then they'd go out into the next block another 3 weeks. They'd go into the next block another 3 weeks. Wow. Well, they can do that because it's a lot lighter vehicle. They don't need to go so far down. We figured out with our frost line we'd need to go further, but still nowhere near as far as an LRT would. We'd still be able to have much less construction impacts than LRT. What are streetcars? Next slide. Catalyze and organize walkable development. This is the biggest difference between buses and streetcars. From a capacity standpoint, as I said before, a streetcar, an articulated bus, streetcar isn't that much bigger. But in terms of development impact, boom, wow, huge difference. In Portland, when they broke all the rules 10 years ago and built a streetcar line without a federal partner in a public-private partnership, they created a brand new neighborhood out of nothing. A former industrial rail yard is now what's called the Pearl District, and everybody wants to live there. It's extraordinarily popular. When you stand in the Pearl District and look at their streetcar line, They have an institution there, which is kind of the equivalent of our Green Institute. Who's heard of the Green Institute? They have an equivalent organization there. If you stand on the roof of their building, and it's in the Pearl District, and you look at the development all around you, you can measure the age of the buildings by their height. The ones that were built while streetcar was under construction, they're like two stories tall, two-story residential buildings, you know, like duplexes, fourplexes. The year after, they're four stories. The year after that, they're seven stories. The year after that, they're 15 stories. Because the developers realized, wow, people really want to live here, and they had to build them bigger and bigger. I asked them if they made any mistakes when I was out in Portland. I went out there with Elizabeth Glidden, Ralph Remington, Robert Lilligren, Gary Schiff, a number of city council members about 5 years ago. We asked them, did you make any mistakes when you built your streetcar, when you created this Pearl District? Out of this former industrial waste area. And here's what they told me. Well, there were some minor things, but the biggest mistake we made was the elementary school. I said, what? They said, we didn't plan for an elementary school. We assumed that our audience for the streetcars was young families who didn't yet have kids and empty nesters who wanted to not take care of a big yard anymore. We assumed those are our two primary audiences, and we were right. But we also assumed that the young families, once they had kids, well, they'd want to move out to the suburbs for a big yard. We were wrong about that. They love the transit-oriented lifestyle of living in the Pearl District, of living fairly close to downtown, but not really being in downtown. They love it, and they want to stay here. And now we want to put an elementary school in the Pearl District, but the land values have all gone up, and we can't afford it anymore. What a wonderful problem that is. Think about all of what cities in America want to do, to grow their tax base, to bring new residences, to reduce urban sprawl, to reduce the growth of congestion, and they're hitting themselves in the head because they didn't plan for an elementary school of people who wanted to live in the city and have their kids go to those schools. I'd love to have that problem to that degree that they do. That's the single biggest impact of streetcars. The potential to grow your city without growing congestion. The other end of the Pearl District, or the other end of the line past the Pearl District, is the Good Samaritan Hospital out in Portland. It used to be one of the most terrible places to try and park out in Portland. After they built the streetcar, the number of residents went up, and the amount of congestion simultaneously went down. This is like the fundamental urban planning problem. How do you get more people and less congestion? They answered the question. They did it in Portland. They did it through transit, urban transit, appropriate for an urban setting, and transit-oriented development to go next to it. So in Minneapolis, we took these experiences, and we've spent time making sure that we were doing it right. And on this next page, you'll see the streetcar feasibility study. What we did, and actually, I can make this part easy on you, because in the Public Works Department, they have the big printers. We don't have them in the mayor's office, but they have nice tools in Public Works. We looked at every bus route in the city of Minneapolis. And believe me, there's a lot more than what you see here. Just to orient you, this is the Central Corridor LRT line. LRT lines are in black, thick black. This is the commuter rail line. You can ignore that for now. So Central Corridor LRT line, Hiawatha LRT, Southwest LRT, unless the Republicans stop it. This can't be stopped anymore. And Botno. We don't exactly know where Botno is going to go or if it's going to go, so it's a dashed line. So we looked at all the bus routes in the city of Minneapolis, and we did everything. We looked at the density along the lines. We looked at the zoning along the lines. We measured the streets underneath the bridges. We measured their widths. We measured them under skyways downtown. And we had to knock out some of them for those technical reasons. There's a bridge on Como Avenue that's too low. You couldn't get a streetcar underneath that. We did a thorough analysis, and we ultimately decided that long-term for the city of Minneapolis, these are the corridors where it would be a mistake to just settle for buses over the next 30, 40 years. It would be a mistake to not pursue upgrading to a streetcar because these are the places where a streetcar can really work. So from that, and we had that plan in place for a while, and then the feds, back on January 10th, they changed the formula for streetcars. As soon as they did that, I worked with the council members, and we made that even tougher decision to narrow down from this and say, okay, we got to put our best foot forward. This is our long-term streetcar system. Our best foot forward, which one of these can really shine in our very first line, can be that first line, like Hiawatha, where the first project changes the whole debate. And that's when we settled on Central Avenue and Nicollet Avenue, which are all equivalent to bus lines, just for the record. This is the number 10. This is the number 18. Chicago's the 5. Hennepin Avenue, University Avenue, that's the 6. I mean, Midtown Corridor is a separate deal. That's not a bus line. But the rest of them are all bus lines. So we're talking about replacing buses with streetcars. And this is what we came up with. But these two bus lines, the 18 and the 10, they overlap through downtown. That's where we have the free service on Nicollet Mall. That's where we wrestled the Met Council, and we got them to agree to have every bus be a hybrid bus. We did that because it's a precursor to what we want to do with streetcars. So let me check to see where I'm at process-wise here. I lost my place. Yeah, I set down my... Oh, yeah, okay. So that's the end of the streetcar section. And before I jumped into BRT, and I knew we were maybe biting off more than we could chew, I wanted to stop there and just talk about streetcars, because if I gave you both new modes all at once, that might be too much. So if we have time, we'll also talk about BRT. I even have a little animation of BRT that I can show people on my computer afterwards. But let me just stop there and take questions about streetcars, modern, classic. Any question? Jeremy.
What is the... my name is Jeremy Lehman. And if anybody else asks a question, please say your name. Peter, one reason I don't take the bus very often is that buses get stuck in traffic. Mm-hmm. And I often find, especially if I'm going downtown, I can walk to downtown from my house nearly as quickly as I can take a bus. So I walk. With the streetcar experience, are they getting stuck in traffic just like buses? Or do they have a particular right of way that would allow them to avoid congestion?
You know, that's a great question. The intention of streetcars is to say they can operate in mixed traffic, but we deliberately skipped certain corridors where we thought the congestion would cause the effect that you're talking about, where people would end up not riding it. For example, Lindell Avenue getting through this bottleneck. It actually has a lot of great transit qualities, but boy, this is a tough nut to crack. The flip side, so that's something that got knocked out. The flip side is one of the main reasons we decided to go first with Nicollet Central as our first foot forward with the federal government is because we actually have a leg up on most other cities in America when it comes to a streetcar project. Like I said, most of the time they operate in mixed traffic. But other cities, when they do a streetcar line, they say to themselves, boy, you know, for most of the line, for most of our streetcar line, we really don't need LRT, we don't need the streetcar to have its own right-of-way. But downtown, we really wish we could get the cars out of the way just downtown, because that's where the streetcars get hung up. Outside downtown, they do fine. In downtown, they really get hung up. Well, on Nicollet and Central, the one place along these lines where we really need our own right-of-way without cars in the way, we have our own right-of-way without cars in the way. That's an advantage for Minneapolis when we compete with these other cities and they're putting forward streetcar projects, because reliability and speed of the vehicle do matter, particularly reliability. Even if you're going a short distance, to be able to turn to the feds and say, yep, congestion's not that big a problem here, but it is a problem here, but don't worry about it in downtown, because between Washington Avenue and whatever it is, 13th, Grant Street, 14th, cars aren't allowed. Other questions?
How many people typically ride a streetcar? What's the capacity?
I didn't bring that capacity number with me. It's just like LRT. They do a seating capacity and a standing capacity.
It's more than a bus, though.
It is more than a bus. Since you brought up the capacity question, and I know I don't have it here, but I'll bet I have it in this folder and I don't want to delay people, I'll get you the answer about capacity afterwards, but you brought up a really great point. I want to tell you about a conversation I had with State Senator Carol Flynn when she was kind of helping me persuade some of these downtown business folks to take a look at streetcars. One of the things we absolutely have to be considering as we look at transit over the next 10, 20, 30 years in this country is we got to be thinking about an aging population. What's one of the advantages of LRT? One of the advantages of LRT, and I'm talking about LRT here, is that we do low-floor vehicles where the floor of the vehicle and the floor of the platform are exactly the same. You don't have to step up into LRT in Minnesota. There are other places in Denver you got to step up into it. Streetcars have the exact same advantage. I regularly take the number 50 or the number 16 on University Avenue. And, you know, I'm on there with the university students, and they got their go-to cards, and they flash and beep, beep, beep. They're on the bus really fast. When somebody who's in a wheelchair has to get on one of those vehicles, you all have, if you've been on a bus, you've seen what the driver has to do. They got to stop. They got to extend the ramp. They gotta actually switch the bus into, I don't know if they turn off the engine, but they put it into some, you know, they put it into park. They get the person in, they have to lock them in place, and then the bus moves again. And we all want an open and accessible society, and so, you know, this is something we deal with. It does affect the reliability of the vehicles in terms of their travel times. You don't have that problem on LRT. People roll right on. They don't need to be locked in because it's a smooth ride, because they're not going to get thrown around. Streetcars have the exact same advantage. low floor, wide door, smooth ride. Just get on and go. It is a much more respectful thing to do. It is a much more ridership-inducing thing to do in, you know, a fully developed city. You want to provide those advantages. Let me be just a little bit more dramatic about this. I was riding on a 50 bus one time, and this was a professional driver. I recognized him. I'd seen him before. This is my regular route. We were in the middle of the university. He extended that ramp. He jammed it into the sidewalk. This happens sometimes. He jammed it in so hard he couldn't extricate the bus. This was an extended bus. Every single person in the peak hour had to get off the bus in the middle of the university campus with all, you know, and wait for another bus to come and pick them up. In a rapidly aging society where we know we need to do this for all these other reasons anyway, we should be thinking about making it really easy for people to take transit. Really easy. Roll on, step on, not climb up into. Big difference. Phyllis.
Simple question. Do all those streetcar systems allow bicycles on them?
You know, that's mixed, actually. We would strongly encourage them to allow bicycles on as opposed to in front of. You notice in front of buses you can do that, but in front of streetcars is different than in front of buses because you'd be standing on the tracks. Now, the tracks are designed to be stood on, so it's not a disaster, but we'd much prefer them to be able to bring them on as they do with an LRT vehicle. It's not consistent in other cities, though. I've seen both. Arvon.
Yeah. Are we going to have to build more wires down the middle of every street?
We would have to build wires, but it would be single wires rather than double wires because you don't need as much power to run a streetcar compared to an LRT. And let me say one more thing about the wires. When I was out in Portland, what the council members and I saw is that good design goes a long way. In Portland, you barely notice that the wires are there, partly because it's their single wires. But the other reason is they got creative at each individual block. Sometimes it's on a pole. Sometimes it's attached to the building. Sometimes they turn it into a piece of artwork. So you're looking at the pole itself is a piece of artwork. So you're looking at the artwork, and then you might notice or might not notice that there's a wire coming off of it. So there would need to be wires. You wouldn't need wires at every single point because the modern streetcars do have the ability to run on their recharging battery power for a block or two. So if you have a particularly problematic intersection, you can skip a space. But in general, you need to think about having that single wire. More questions? Paul.
Well, I was wondering if you could reinforce the construction differences between the LRT and the streetcar in terms of selling this. And I love streetcars, but as good an impact on the psyche of the public as the Hiawatha line had favorably, the construction that's going along University Avenue is as bad a reaction the other way. I mean, you probably have experienced it.
You bet.
But the businesses along there are terrified. And so I think that if people think mass transit, they think LRT, streetcar, some people are younger even than the people here. They won't remember riding streetcars. I think you're going to have a real public relations problem if those lines get blurred in people's minds.
You're absolutely right, and we are concerned about that. We're concerned about that in general as it relates to the Central Corridor line, and let me break that into a couple of pieces. There are several ways that streetcars are different from the impacts that you're going to see on Central Corridor. One is the time that I referred to earlier. 4 years of construction on the Central Corridor line, as opposed to out in Portland, they were able to get in and out of individual blocks in 3 weeks. Much less time. Another important difference is the parking difference. Because LRT needed its own space on the Central Corridor line, it had to come out of somewhere. And because the decision was made to maintain that many flow lanes of traffic, the thing that got sacrificed is parking. And the businesses along University Avenue are really freaked out about the loss of parking. That's not an issue with a streetcar because a streetcar is sharing an existing lane with other vehicles. So the parking impact is very small. Maybe at some particular intersections, as opposed to on Central Corridor, where the parking impact is wholesale. It's like the entire corridor. A third difference is the after-the-fact difference, because what you'll hear from Central Corridor businesses, they're worried about the construction time, they're worried about the parking impact. They're also worried about what's going to happen afterwards. Afterwards, they're thinking to themselves, the property values are going to go so high because the change in the street, because the vehicle brings so many people, it changes the street so much that they're going to get developed out of their businesses. Streetcars, while they have a big development impact, it's you don't need to have an LRT-sized impact in order to justify building a streetcar. So the development impact is much more manageable. In order to justify an LRT, you got to have an even more dramatic impact if you're on a developable corridor like Central. So I would make the case, and I'm glad you called on me to draw it out, that there are three dramatic ways where a streetcar shouldn't frighten people in the way that the Central Core has frightened people. Let me play that debate out just a little bit more. There are folks within the transportation community here who would say that we made a mistake on Central Corridor, that the Central Corridor should have been a streetcar. I don't agree with that. When you look at the size of those vehicles, in order for a streetcar to handle the same capacity as an LRT, which is four times as long when it's in that three-car train, you'd have to run the streetcar four times as frequently. I just think that's too much. What I take from that debate about should Central have been a streetcar or an LRT, it should have been an LRT. But what we should take from that is there will never be another corridor in this region like the Central Corridor. Never. Let me come to this map for just a second. So what do you see on here? Where does LRT make sense? On Hiawatha, you have gigantic ridership drivers. Downtown Minneapolis, the airport, the Mall of America. And on each end, downtown Minneapolis, the Mall of America, with the airport in between. On Central, you have downtown Minneapolis, downtown St. Paul, with the University of Minnesota in between. These are the places where you got to have a really huge capacity vehicle. I get on the 50, and I can't get a seat. And I live basically at the city border. That's not going to handle the need moving forward. And a streetcar wouldn't be able to handle the need moving forward either. As soon as you get past those two examples, Central and Hiawatha, you immediately get harder to justify an LRT vehicle. Downtown Minneapolis, yes, but there's no university here. And while the job center down in Eden Prairie is significant, it's not that big. Bottineau's even harder in terms of having those gigantic anchors. The reason that these two still work is because there's no interstate next to them. It's cutting the diagonal. There's an interstate heading straight south. There's an interstate set, 35W, there's an interstate heading straight west, 394. And this cuts the diagonal. So, for example, somebody who's, riding their car to downtown Minneapolis right now from down here, well, they're taking 62 and 35. You're getting somebody off two freeways in the morning if they can ride Southwest LRT instead. Or maybe they're taking 100 and 394. You're getting them off two highways if you get them on Southwest. So cutting the diagonal means you got a rich zone of people who are looking for an alternative. And by getting them off the freeway, you're getting them off more than one freeway. Part of what I'm getting to is you're seeing, again, the limits of LRT. So you have Central making sense because of gigantic ridership generators. Hiawatha justified for LRT because it has gigantic ridership generators. And you have one, maybe two more, that are justified because you have one gigantic ridership generator, plus you're cutting the diagonal not next to an interstate. Same thing up here, hopefully, for Bottineau. And then, frankly, I think you're done with LRT. And if you want to have the growth that we want to have, you got to bring some new tools into the mix. I think if we tried to put an LRT on Nicollet or Chicago or Hennepin or West Broadway, I think we would have a revolution on our hands, because people would look at the experience of Central and they'd say, well, that might have been necessary because you got the U and you got St. Paul. That's not necessary for us. Don't do it to us. The businesses can't handle it. And they'd be right. In the case of Central, we just gotta get through it, because LRT was the only thing that would work. Sean.
So I noticed that the Nicollet line goes down south of Lake Street. It would go through that Kmart that's there, and I know that's one of the city's priorities. Can you talk about how getting rid of that Target and trying to get a streetcar line all the way down Nicollet? Can you just expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, great question. Some folks have looked at that and said, well, you got Kmart in the way. Isn't that an impediment? Oh, no, it's not. That's a goal. you might take a bus and have it take three 90-degree turns to get around a Kmart. And that's what the number 18 bus does. It takes three 90-degree turns to get around a Kmart. Four 90-degree turns to get around a Kmart. A streetcar can do that. Like I said, it can take an urban corner. But we wouldn't. We would plow through. And that is part of the reason why we want to do this. The fact that it's been closed off up to now actually is accidentally helpful, because it's established travel patterns that mean that the Eat Street section north of there is not that congested, and we would want to do it all at once. I mean, so it's good in a couple of different ways. But believe me, the council members who represent this, they were thrilled that we were doing something that would force the question, that would allow us to get rid of Kmart through eminent domain.
How much snow can a streetcar go through if the plows aren't keeping up?
I'm glad streetcars do very well. What's that?
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. She asked how streetcars can handle snow if the plows aren't ahead of the game. A dramatic thing happened this year. Metro Transit actually shut down most of their system for, I think they did it at like 10 o'clock in the morning for the rest of the day on the day that we got that worst snow. They shut down most of their system except for one thing. The Hiawatha LRT line was operating, because steel wheels on steel rails can make it through snow. And while a streetcar isn't as heavy as an LRT, it does have steel wheels on steel rails, and it will do better, just like LRT will do better. Right here.
Could you consider a monorail, which only requires planting posts through the route instead of digging up the street and putting rails and so on?
Within this study, no. Within broader transportation policy in planning in the city, yes, we did. Here's the conclusion we came to about monorail systems. First of all, since a big part of what we're looking for is street-level activity, street-level development, and the accessibility of being able to walk on or roll on to a vehicle as opposed to being to climb into, all of those things argue for a streetcar and not for any kind of elevated system. There are folks in Minneapolis who advocated for a particular type of monorail system called personal rapid transit. I don't want to go too far afield, but I just want to point out one thing about Minneapolis, which usually ends the conversation about personal rapid transit in Minneapolis. Skyways. We have skyways in Minneapolis. Former Councilmember Dean Zimmerman, we have skyways in the city of Minneapolis. The place where a personal rapid transit might make sense at some point in the future, and I realize there are other monorail systems other than that, but I wanted to riff off your question and answer this, because it often gets asked. The place where a system like that might make sense is where you've just got so much happening at the street level, you gotta go somewhere else to find any, even if it costs more, you gotta go somewhere else to get any additional capacity, like Manhattan. Well, we're not Manhattan. We don't have it that much that we can't get more capacity out of the street at a lower cost. And more importantly, we have skyways and they're in the way. Somebody's going to make a system like that work, but it's not going to be downtown Minneapolis or downtown St. Paul. Mm-hmm. Arvon?
You're talking about platform getting on means that you're going to have to build platforms mm-hmm. that are as high as the streetcar.
Yep.
Will those be in the middle of the street, or are you going to run the streetcar along one side of the street?
Great question. The classic streetcars that rode in, that operated in the city of Minneapolis for the most part, and this was the same in most other cities, operated in the middle of the street. That was by no means the main reason for their demise, but that was one of the reasons for their demise. Frankly, they were built for kind of a monopoly era. As cars grew and people were getting off of classic streetcars into the middle of the street and there were cars coming both directions, that frightened a lot of people from using the system. It was unsafe. For that reason, we are looking almost exclusively at curb running. You don't have to run a streetcar in a curb. You don't have to run LRT in a curb. You notice that LRT stations, they have center platforms, they have side platforms. But even if you have a center platform, you have a center platform that people can get to without stepping up into it. It's a gradual slope. You walk into the center and then you are up there, and the platform is like twice as high as a normal curb. It's not that high, and you can get to it without stepping on a curb like that. When we get to a Hennepin Avenue streetcar, hopefully in the future, that might be a question. That was the one corridor where people thought center platforms might make sense. But for the purposes of this first project, I think it'll be entirely curbside, which is the easiest and most accessible for everybody. Yet another reason why we picked, there were lots of reasons why we picked Central and Nicollet to go first. Central is, compared to the rest of these streets, really wide. You could have a full parking lane, you could have a streetcar slashed other cars shared lane, still have another lane and maybe accommodate turn lanes. Nicollet is narrower, so there may be places where the streetcar is running in the center as it's running and then pulling over to the curb for the sake of picking up passengers, but it would always be at the curb for picking up passengers. The important thing is, other than those places where the stations are, well, I won't even say that. Where the stations are, the same places the bus stops are now, so there's not parking there now, so you wouldn't be losing parking. And you might ask yourself, well, if somebody parks in the wrong place, can't that mess up the streetcar? It's a good question. Out in Portland, they pretty much tackled this problem. They made sure that it does require greater vigilance in terms of snow removal, to get to the question that was asked earlier. You couldn't do the thing that we end up doing where we just let it accumulate out into the street. And I don't say let. We do that because sometimes you just can't pile the vehicle, the plows can't pile the snow high enough. On these corridors, we would need to spend a little bit more money on snow removal to make sure it didn't pile up that way. Although the streetcars themselves help prevent that when they're operating in the curb lane. But to make sure that they don't fill up the parking lane and push the parked cars into the streetcar lane, you do need to be more vigilant about snow removal. In Portland, they found that regular cars were not a problem. And when that rarely happened, they have a system for towing them away right away, and it doesn't affect operations. They had a little bit more problem with delivery vehicles than they did with regular folks, because the delivery vehicles who are not regular users tended to be a little more oblivious. You know what I mean? But it was the same deal. They said in some particular instances they wish they had put in an additional foot where there was a frequency of delivery vehicles, but that's something where we can learn from their experience. In general, they mastered that problem.